Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And I have to remind you that when you look at that debt clock, not one penny on that debt clock is legitimate. It's all fraud. And they're going to be coming to us and saying, oh, we can't service the debt. We have a real financial crisis and a financial problem, and we need to put aside the Constitution. Folks, if you haven't risen up by then, you better make your stand. And as a matter of fact, this is why you need to start getting in the grill of every public servant so that they know that that debt clock is fraud, that we're being set up. Anyway, I don't want to go into those details because we're covering the Constitution this week and the next few weeks, whatever it takes to get through it. And we've got Tammy Young back. Tammy, thank you so much for being a part of this.
Thank you.
And so let me just kind of catch everything up for where we left off. And one of my faux pas or my, you know, mea culpa, I realized that I have not really covered what parts are being violated, especially when it comes to these powers. I know we talked about the uniformity clause and how it violates the 16th Amendment, or the 16th Amendment violates it. But out of all of the powers, I could just say, folks, every power is being violated except for three. And the first one that has not been violated, that we didn't really cover, but I should say, I didn't identify it as a violation, but it's one that wasn't a violation, which is to provide for punishment of counterfeiting the securities and coin of the United States. In other words, they're doing a good job at that. As a matter of fact, I'll say this because, and let me ask you, because this is something I need to air. I believe that this really should be yellow. And I'm saying this because I believe that the government has gone down this path today that has created this hyperbole regarding our currency. In other words, they did and have done a really good job in protecting the currency. But I believe that they're convincing everybody that counterfeiting is out of hand. What I mean by that is I constantly hear, you know, that, oh, we're having to change the dollar again because of all these counterfeiting problems. And as a matter of fact, if you've ever watched the TV show Reacher, and Reacher basically kind of put it out there on a counterfeiting episode where there was this collusion of, you know, rogue agents in government. I honestly think that there's probably more to do with the deep state in government, not just a couple rogue agents, but there's probably a deep state that is, you know, constantly making these changes, not because of this, you know, this currency problem, because why did they start putting the magnetic strip in the $20 bills and above? They started
to track us.
There you go, because that magnetic strip gave them information as to when we would go through. Because I had a friend in the Marine Corps in the early 90s when they started putting the magnetic strip in, and he went to Hawaii and he had a few thousand dollars in his pocket. And when he went through customs, it went off on the fact that when he got to Hawaii, it went off. It basically told him he had a lot of money on him, and they basically took his money and said, "We believe you're coming here to buy drugs." And so he fought and fought and fought. He goes, "Are you kidding me? I'm a gunnery sergeant in the Marine Corps, and you know I take drug tests all the time. I'm in the intelligence community." And they did not give him his money back.
Really?
And it's a way of confiscating property, and it's a way of control. And when I left Hawaii, he still was fighting for his money back. Right.
Yeah, so I suppose if you have a bunch of money stashed in your home, they can just... they would know that too.
Right. And as far as they're concerned, they have laws that say you can't have that much money. And actually, there have been court cases that have actually proven that those laws are unconstitutional. That's your property. It's not government property. See, when you when we understand, and this is why we went through the ratification debates on this, and it's worth bringing up now. In the ratification debates, they went back and forth to talk about the essence of property, that the government is not to control or own our property, that actually that money and that currency is provided to us as our property. In other words, when you boil down your estate, you can basically take all of your physical property and liquidate that into currency, and that becomes a new form of your property. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
But that is still your property.
Right.
So when you liquidate and you basically create this pile of, let's call it, you know, gold bars, silver bars, and coins, then you now have, you know, everything that you owned, all the clothes on your back and everything, now literally sitting in the most condensed pile you could put your property in. Selling your home, your houses, all your real estate, now you literally have in, again, the most condensed form, your estate. That is yours. And then if, you know, you happen to be, you die, you pass away, then your will basically take that and divide that based on your wishes down to the people. The reason that they don't want you to have that property, that physical property, is because they can't trace it. If you, in your hand, have a gold or a silver bar, and you reach over and hand that bar to somebody, then that bar becomes a transfer of goods that literally is, help me out here, an untraceable transaction. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yep, yep.
Okay, so then that way they can't actually confirm whether you had that or not. So they want to control all that. And so they're putting measures in place that they want to know when you buy gold and where that gold is, when you buy silver and where that silver is. And
yes, basically the government, instead of being there to protect our property, is there to make sure we don't have any property now.
Right, right. So, all that being said, what we want to do is we want to dive into the these powers. But again, what they're trying to do with the digital currency and this responsibility the federal government has in maintaining gold and silver coin and commutable bills. I mean, it's one thing, and I think we talked about this, it's one thing to have bills that you can take down to the Treasury and convert that into, you know, literally, you know, gold or silver.
Gold, silver, yeah.
Right, because, you know, then they're still honoring the concept of our currency. But the fact that they completely abandoned that is makes that, you know, totally a violation. So the question is, because they're abandoning it, should this one line be yellow? Because before we move on, I honestly think that they are actually trying to subvert our currency by continually telling us that we have counterfeiting problems. It doesn't matter. And as a matter of fact, when it comes down to it, if we went back to gold and silver, we wouldn't have counterfeiting problems.
Right.
Right? Because they can create, you know, fake gold, but that doesn't mean it's real gold. You have to have real gold. And so the fact that they're just making bills look like bills, but if we actually had a gold and silver currency, then they couldn't have counterfeiting. Or I should say, the counterfeiting problem would really, you know, not be what we would think it is. It would basically be fake gold, it would be fake silver. And there are really quick tests that you could actually do, because if you're holding a piece of lead that's gold, you know, all you got to do is just drop it in, because they got water tests and these weight tests and so forth that'll prove whether that's gold or not, or whether that's silver. And right. Folks, if you don't have one and you have gold and silver, you need to get those little, you know, you can carry them around with you so you can actually prove that this is legitimate silver and show people with this measuring systems that they have out there that you can use these things. But anyway, so what I want to do is we need to kind of move forward. And we left off again with the rights of writings and or copyrights and patents and those types of things. We've kind of covered that. So the next one that we're going to cover, and I'll just go ahead and read it, because this one is another one. This is the second one out of the powers that's not being violated. And I don't think that they're going to violate this, because it's a kind of a generic power that the Congress shall have the power to constitute tribunals inferior to the Supreme Court. They're doing that. And as a matter of fact, they've done that to ad nauseum as they've grown, because we were talking about this before we started recording, how the court mm-hmm. system has grown its powers because they want to have control over everything. They've expanded their jurisdiction. They've created a judiciary form of government. And that's how we're literally being controlled by a court system. And they have so many federal courts today that they don't need.
So that should be yellow too then.
So they do have the power to do this. Are they violating it? Yeah, you know what? Maybe we need a new color. Maybe we need a new color of how they're using it for abuses.
Yeah.
But you know what? Maybe yellow is appropriate. You know, so I don't know. What do you think?
Let's see. Yellow means...
yeah, so... If I go all the way up to the top again, yellow means that they're serious violations. So, in other words, these are direct violations. But I honestly think maybe we need to put like a blue or some other color that would basically say that they're abusing these powers not to violate but to aggrandize. You know, mm-hmm. like the, you know, they're aggrandizing the court system. And these are ways to abuse, you know, or, you know, wage tyranny. I honestly think, you know what, I will go ahead and do that. And I am going to, because I think it's really important that people realize the magnitude of how our government has gone outside the Constitution. How they've literally taken it upon themselves to do what they need to do to bring an end, because literally our government is trying to destroy our Constitution and our form of government. So I'm looking at not gray, you know what, olive drab. I will use olive drab for these where they're abusing these powers to take us down the wrong paths. So, in other words, even though they're not technically violating, they're using them as weapons. And so, to help support some of these other things that they're doing. Now, when we look at, because see, you got direct violations where in this next one, go ahead and read the next one. Congress shall have the power. This is subsection 9. Congress shall have the power to.
Wait, I was up in.
That would be define and punish. Oh, you're not there.
Hold on, I wasn't there because I went back.
See, we're not sharing the screen, folks. So she's not seeing what you know. We're independently.
Oh, to define, are we on 9?
Yes, we're on 9, subsection 9.
Okay. Oh, to define and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas and offenses against the law of nations.
And so in the offenses against the law of nations, they're supposed to have the power. That right there means that they have jurisdiction over international law. And actually, they're violating that because the Supreme Court has invoked international law to basically govern us. As a matter of fact, I believe it was Sandra Day O'Connor that actually, you know, infused international law in one of the rulings that she made. And, or no, I'm sorry, it wasn't Sandra Day O'Connor. It was Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And so Justice Ginsburg was the one that invoked international law into a ruling when the progressive court got away with doing something. But they've embraced all of this. This is, and through the treaties, they've actually brought in international law by subjugating us to the UN. They do not have the power to subjugate. This is not a power given to them to actually put us under international law. This is a responsibility for them to actually have the power to define and punish. They have the jurisdiction. The federal government has jurisdiction over how international law will be defined and punished within the United States. They don't have the jurisdiction, or they don't have the authority to actually put us under the jurisdiction of foreign entities. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So, anyway, when we actually look at the other crimes that they're committing, and, you know, we kind of, or not they're committing, the other crimes that they've assumed control over, like drugs, like kidnapping, you know, like, you know, alcohol, they've created all of these laws that basically say you can't, you know, create this moonshine. Now, it's one thing to say you're evading taxes, you know, because moonshine guys, that's what, you know, they're doing that under the table, right? If you're producing right. anything, whether it's moonshine, whether it's furniture, anything you do, and you're actually, you know, producing and selling it, and you're making income off it, and you're not recording that for taxes, then, oh, they got you for tax evasion. Because they right. do have the power. And that's one of the ways they've actually been able to go after people is for tax evasion. Now, when we look at how they execute the tax laws, they do not have the power to execute the law. In other words, when we get down a few more lines, we'll actually clarify this. So, but the next one, number 10, is the Congress shall have the power to
declare war, grant letters of marque and reprisal, and make rules concerning captures on land and water.
There you go. And so this is actually being violated because many times they don't properly declare war. Secondly, they've actually given unconstitutionally, because there's no amendment here that basically says that the president can declare war or take action. What they did was they started creating acts to say, we'll allow the president these latitudes. And actually, we already covered that with the Whiskey Rebellion, remember?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. So as we look at how Congress kind of started side, and you know what? This again, excuse me, this goes down in looking at how the people and Congress at the time in the very first, four years of those two sessions and then the following two sessions. So it was a total of four sessions of President Washington's administration. They had such regard and revere, they did not want to insult this man. And so they bent over backwards with the best intent of saying, you know, we do not even think you have any guile or any, you know, bad intentions. So we're going to grant you something we don't even have the authority to do. You have the ability to basically call upon the militia directly bypassing us, even though the Constitution says we have to do it because we don't want to insult you and say you have to do it. And we would rather you do because you do what you ever need to do. I mean, this was like really political theatrics, if you understand. And what actually happened in George Washington's farewell address, he literally came out and said, and I'm going to let you read the next one while I pull up his farewell address, because it's worth actually giving everybody a chance to let, you know, them hear exactly what George Washington said regarding the best intentions, because he actually highlights the fact that in his farewell address, do not allow the government to do things with good intentions. Make them change the Constitution. Make them adhere to the Constitution, because governments that exercise good intentions is how good governments are destroyed. And so I'm paraphrasing. So I want to read that, because as we look at, you know, both the Whiskey Rebellion and as we look at this particular this particular part of declaring war and giving him that grant of doing that, that right there helps everybody start to see that they already started going down the path that Washington said, hey, and you know what? He didn't even point to the fact that, you know, hey, Congress already gave me the opportunities and don't let them do this. But he didn't say that because it, you know, would probably look bad for him. Does that make sense? Okay. So he kind of sidestepped it, but he did admonish the people, please do not let them use good intentions to violate the Constitution. Now, letters of marque and reprisal and to make rules concerning captures on land and water. Now, when we go into this, we know that state governments and state police forces are actually capturing and seizing property, because, and this all has to do with whether this is identified as a threat under the Constitution. In other words, there's points in time where the government is actually granted, you know, captures and reprisals and marquees over, you know, seizing these ships or boats that are coming in with drugs. And so this has become so cloudy, it is an orange highlight. In other words, this is a serious problem that they've extended these powers and they've ignored these constraints that Congress has to do this. They've just basically opened the floodgates in allowing everybody to start seizing property, because that's technically letters of marque and reprisal, to seize that property and take it from foreign entities. Because of warfare, because they're considered an actual military threat to us, a national security threat. Under the guise of laws like drug laws, well, they consider that a threat, but the federal government doesn't have jurisdiction over drug laws. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, they started using this as a way to actually obtain property, because what do they do with those ships that they seize? Well, they auction them off and sell them, or they give them away to those people they want to grant favor to.
What do they do with all the drug money?
That, and again, it's not just the drug money, but the property they take from those people, American citizens or foreigners, when they take that property, that is actually, it goes in, it's theirs. They take it.
Do they fund the police with drug money?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Or they fund the state, right? So anyway, go ahead and let's read the next one. That Congress shall have the power to, this is 11.
11, to raise and support armies, but no appropriation of money to that use shall be for a longer term than 2 years.
Okay, so the concept of having armies funded for more than 2 years to make sure that they couldn't. In other words, here's the thing, that unless you have a very specific exigency, and now we ran out of time, we're going into break. So we'll dive into the exigencies, but actually before we do that, when we come back, I will have George Washington's farewell address, so that I can kind of read how George Washington warned the nation not to let the government use good intentions like emergency powers, those types of things to protect us, to actually take away our rights. Anyway, we'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so this is what George Washington said in his farewell address, because let me just kind of cover this first, okay? And so this is in paragraph 26, and I do that because I take out all the paragraphs to make it easier for citation for you to find this. But anyway, in paragraph 26, the last half of this paragraph is where he hits the nail on the head. He says, "The necessity of reciprocal checks in the exercise of political power by dividing and distributing it into different depositories and constituting each the guardian of the public well against invasions by others." And he's not talking about military invasions. He's talking about, you know, the courts invading the legislature and or, you know, the people invading us. But this is very specific regarding government. Well against invasions by the others has been evinced by experiments ancient and modern, some of them in our country and under our own eyes. So it's kind of like this little stealth way of saying, we've just recently done this. To preserve them must be a necessary as to institute them. If, in the opinion of the people, the distribution or modification of the constitutional powers, like they gave him with military powers and then calling forth the militia, he says, the distribution or modification of the constitutional powers be in any particular wrong, let it be corrected by an amendment in the way which the Constitution designates. In other words, an Article 5 amendment. But let there be no change by usurpation, for through this, or good intentions, same, for through this, in one instance, may be the instrument of good, it is the customary weapon by which free governments are destroyed. The precedent must always greatly overbalance in permanent evil any partial or transient benefit which the use can at any time yield. So as hard as that may be for people to hear, because the, you know, the type of language or is vernacular, he's literally telling people, do, regardless of what the benefit is for them to just do good for you, like saving the children from, you know, an outbreak of yellow fever, do not let them just do that. Make them get an amendment or do without, because you're better off doing without than allowing them to continually trample, because as they assume power, they continually grow the power they assume to a point where we now have a government that is no longer under any fancy of control. They believe they can do anything and everything that they want. And that is not based or founded upon our Constitution and these doctrines that the framers created. So anyway, does that help?
Yeah.
And it's interesting how he actually pointed out that even, you know, in our own eyes, we've kind of seen this happen. And like I said, that was kind of a veiled admission that it happened with him. Anyway, okay, so we just covered this. You just read the raise and support armies, but no appropriation of money to that use shall be for a term longer than 2 years. So if you really think about this army that they're creating, this army is a limited army that can only do very specific things. And so we'll get into that in a subsequent power. But this next power was one that I kind of mentioned, how they ignored this in the very first 8 years under Washington's presidency, which is to provide, or actually Congress will have the power to
provide and maintain a Navy.
Period. Create that Navy and get that thing going. And they didn't do it. Interesting, right? Okay, so this next one, which, as far as I'm concerned, is another one that is actually, you know, they're not violating this. I can't think of a way they are. Go ahead. Congress will have the power to
make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces.
There you go. So they've got the UCMJ. They have these. And as a matter of fact, the UCMJ that they created, technically, they're no longer abiding by. Currently, in the existing UCMJ, if a person commits adultery, if a member of the armed forces commits adultery, they're to be court-martialed. They don't enforce that anymore. But it's still in there. And there's other moral laws that they have in there that they don't enforce. They've created these policies without changing the laws themselves to basically say don't ask, don't tell, and those types of things. And they make it ambiguous and really hard, and they've literally taken our armed forces into a cesspool of social engineering. And they've no longer, because technically, when you really look at, a U.S. service member, you have no rights. When you become a service member, they have full control over you and your body. They can take you and send you anywhere for the good of the country and have you do anything. But they've actually basically stood back and said, you know what? We're not going to control you. We're going to kind of let you do whatever you want. And this is how they've started empowering and created, I'll just say, a level of chaos amongst the ranks, because the military is an autocratic society, from the top down. It's not a bottom up. And they've actually gone into over the past three, four decades, actually probably the beginning of the first Gulf War, is when they started inducing lawyers into the commands to basically make sure, and as they've improved technology and everything else, they literally have changed the military to become a political force instead of actually having generals making decisions. All decisions come from the White House, and it's all about politics. They've politicized the entire military. And, to dive into this really probably would take a few shows. But bottom line, when they started improving communications to where the president could literally talk to a field commander or somebody from the White House, by the guidance of the president, could literally talk to some captain in a foxhole or some person on a helicopter, basically say, go in and do this, then they've taken away the full chain of command, and they've allowed this full level of control from a central single point. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And what that has done is, and the way they've had to invoke these things, it has caused nothing but problems. But bottom line, this goes back to the archaic design of our military, the fact that we have two ranks. Why do we have officers and enlisted? As a matter of fact, when you really look at what the enlisted do, the enlisted are the guys that actually make that aircraft fly. they have to have a level of skill and training to troubleshoot why that aircraft won't fly, fix it, make it fly, so that the guy with the college degree can go up there not knowing all of the stuff that's inside that and how to make that thing work. They can't fix it, but they sure can crash it.
Yeah.
In other words, you know, are we really at that point where the guy flying the aircraft is more important than the guys making it? Because that's how the rank structures were, because the enlisted were dumb, uneducated. They couldn't even sign their own name. They had to usually use an X that required an officer to witness that that was that person. I mean, that's how, you know, the need for having these two separate rank structures existed 200-300 years ago. But today, that's all, well, I should say, in the 60s and 70s, that really went by the wayside. It really, you know, when our education system got so good that we actually could do some really phenomenal things with technology and so on. I mean, look, we've got enlisted people doing really, you know, incredible things with skills and technical training. Where, you know, the officers, they couldn't even figure out what to do. They've got these other degrees in political science or what have you. Anyway, I'm just ranting a little bit. But my point is that when we look at the military and its funding, its design was not to be a standing army. They were not to have a standing army. The intent was to only use it for its purpose, not to create a permanent strategic need. The permanent strategic need was that line above to provide and maintain a Navy. That was the strategic force to be created to deal with all external threats. The Army was strictly only necessary to deal with the, well, we'll get into that, because what's this next one?
Congress shall have for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions.
That right there is your army. The militia was the source of the army. So in other words, when they needed to have the army, the Congress would call forth the militia, because we saw this with the Whiskey Rebellion. After the Revolutionary War, we didn't have an army. The army was completely dismissed. We had this thing called the War Department. And the War Department was just people that, you know, was trying to figure out what to do and creating regulations. And nine times out of ten, when you create somebody that, you know, has this little do-nothing job, next thing you know, they want to have people under them. And they want to have more people under them. And when you looked at the War Department compared to the State Department and the Treasury, the War Department was just, you know, basically bones. It was just a structure because they didn't have an army. And Washington, being an army man, he kind of had this desire to, you know, to do something regarding the army. And so that's why the first thing that they did militarily was they called forth the militia for the Whiskey Rebellion. And when the militia is called forth, that's when they federalize it, and that's when it becomes the army.
So when the militia was called forth, were they obligated?
Yes, so they were obligated to execute the laws of the Union. So when they're being called in, they were actually being called in to basically enforce those whiskey tax laws. Does that make sense?
And so were the citizens obligated to join the militia?
Yeah, so no. So in each state already had, they were supposed to maintain the militia. As a matter of fact, we'll get into that. We'll get into some subsequent powers, but there was this symbiotic relationship between the federal government and the states for maintaining and equipping, training, and preparing and creating standards of the militia. But right here, what we're dealing with is this is where the standing army is formed. And so the standing army is to be formed for, what are they pulling them for? They're pulling them to execute the laws of the Union. So they only had them up for maybe a month or two. And as a matter of fact, remember what Washington said about the army. He said they did really good, but we could have done much better, and we need to do better. He was worried about the readiness of the militia. So remember, in those Whiskey Rebellion comments, he kind of put these little comments out there that we needed to put more focus on this army, this federalizing the militia thing. So, you know, as the army general that he was, that's where his focus was, and not a peep, at least as far as I'm concerned, there was really no hardcore effort in creating that Navy and maintaining and actually creating the true force that would have the strategic responsibility to protect us from the world. Technically, when you look at what the Air Force does and most of its roles, because most of its roles are strategic in protecting us from external forces, that's mm-hmm. the Navy's responsibility, not the Air Force. When we look at Trump creating Space Force and saying, okay, the Space Force is going to protect us from threats in space and outer space, that's the Navy. In other words, these functions and responsibilities technically belong to the Navy. If it is not a part of the United States land and territories, then are you know, the sovereign states and the territories that should be becoming states, then as far as I see this, you know, the Navy should be responsible for all of that external stuff. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So in other words, we really only have one force, and a part of that force, actually technically the Navy is two forces in one, right? You've got the seaborne function of the Navy, and the landborne function of the Navy is the Marine Corps. And so when I tell people, you know, that they were, you know, because I meet veterans all the time, they hate to hear me say this, that it's too bad you were in the unconstitutional force. You know, if you were in the Navy or if you're in the Air Force, right? Because they really didn't have the constitutional authority to create these things, if that makes sense. So as we go into the next one, because this is where it all, you know, starts to make sense, because Congress and the states had a symbiotic relationship in maintaining this this readiness structure that needed to exist. Technically, and let me back up, because you've never heard me say this, but this is a part of my shows, that the enforcement of the law and the rule of law is dependent upon we the people, because who is the militia? It is we the people. So when we started creating municipal law enforcement, when we started creating, you know, the city law enforcement, instead of using the county and the militia, then we started turning our back on the people being a part of, you know, this self-governing system. Not only are we supposed to have a voice in our system, but we're actually supposed to execute the laws. And so if you really think about it, because I actually had
we should have a town militia.
So actually, no, it should be county. The top cop of the county is the sheriff. And so the fact that we have any law enforcement, city, municipal, or state, see, the state is the counties. So instead of having a state patrol or a state enforcement, it should actually be county by county by county. Mm-hmm. And so it's one thing for the governor to have a marshal, you know, a marshal force like the federal marshals that actually kind of are – They don't actually, you know, deploy guns and people, but what they do is they work with the local law enforcement. And so that's how it was the marshal that worked with the sheriff in Pennsylvania for collecting of taxes, because that's what the marshal did. He was there to make sure that, you know, the taxes were being collected. And, you know, he was kind of overseeing that because they had to make sure, because if you don't hold people accountable, you know, then they won't pay.
Well, sure.
Right. And so they had to have some mechanism to make sure that and when all of a sudden there was a large section of Pennsylvania that just wasn't paying, and not only were they not paying, they were revolting against paying, then that marshal and that sheriff had to do things which escalated into the Whiskey Rebellion. And so what they needed at that point, instead of creating the IRS, instead of creating the ATF, because this was both an alcohol and tax thing, But the federal government has actually created both of those entities when the framers of the Constitution started dealing with this problem of taxation and the production of alcohol. They didn't create federal bureaucracies. They called forth the militia to bring them into the, you know, the proper functioning and getting them to play nice and doing what they're supposed to do. Getting the people to enforce the law. So had we done a better job at maintaining and understanding, instead of abandoning the militia, because George Mason really covered this in the Virginia Ratification Debate, he gave the recipe of how the militia would go by the wayside because both the state and federal government would ignore it. And he said, when they start to ignore it, then they will prove that it is no longer necessary, and they will start creating their own armies, and next thing you know, they'll create standing armies, and they will start creating their own laws and enforcing their own laws. And that's what we have today. So when you look at the FBI is a standing army. When you look at the ATF, that is a standing army. When you look at the park reserves, or I should say the park enforcements, you know, you got these park rangers, that is a standing army, because they are enforcing their own laws. When you go through the ratification debates, it was very clear that the federal government was not to have the power to enforce its own laws. They were to use the militia so that we would be an ultimate check on tyranny. In other words, right. When the people had to...
If it was a tyrannical law...
There you go. See?
Citizens wouldn't enforce it.
Now you can start seeing the beautiful thing about this system that we were given. And instead, people wanted to get busy to make more money instead of being a part of this body government and actually fulfilling our responsibilities. Ah. So we actually started, you know, accepting mercenary forces like, you know, town law enforcement, state law enforcement, and so forth. And when you create a mercenary force, you instantly create the argument that the people should not have to have guns. And as a matter of fact, we need to take their guns because they don't want to be dealing with people with guns. These mercenary forces do not want to be shot at. They want to rule us. You see how you see how this whole thing gets subverted when we start actually injecting things that don't belong in our system.
So how do they have a county? How would they go about doing that? Do they get paid? Is it voluntary? Like the county militia?
You know what? So this is a great question, and this is a question that we need to probably dive into after we cover the Constitution, because I'd like to get through this.
Okay.
But because then you can start thinking about it. So write that question down. And while I'm talking, you go ahead and just take a quick moment to type out on a notepad or whatever on your computer or on a piece of paper. We need to dive into how the people, you know, need to take over the enforcement of the law. But as we start, you know, getting through this content and we're done with that and we get through the rest of the content, that's a great topic to actually bring up so that we can actually examine in detail how we the people have this responsibility of enforcing the law. As a matter of fact,
because most people are just trying to make ends meet.
I understand that, but every state in the nation, every state in this republic has to have laws on the books to call forth the people to take arms, to actually defend and support the Constitution of the United States against enemies foreign and domestic. In other words, they have to have these militia laws because the Constitution still demands it. Many states are trying to scuttle those or ignore those. And I wouldn't put it past that there are probably some states out there, like maybe Massachusetts, that's actually deleted those laws and say, we're not going to do that anymore. But the Constitution still demands it. And as a matter of fact, the citizenship, the process of naturalization, every person that becomes a citizen has to raise their arm to the square and actually testify and swear or affirm that they will take up arms to support the Constitution and defend it against enemies, foreign and domestic. Not the president, not the state governor, not, you know, not some office or party. we have a responsibility to support and defend the Constitution. And when we start understanding and we start learning this, and we actually start understanding, you know, what the Constitution really is and what it isn't, then all of a sudden our eyes start opening up and going, you know what? We've inflicted so much misery upon ourselves, and we've actually strapped ourselves with all of this debt unconstitutionally. You know, as America starts waking up, you know, I have this dream that we actually cut all of these chains, all of these strings that the globalists have control over us, that we actually say, you know what, screw you. We have no need for you. We're going to go back to actually producing everything because we have all the minerals here. We have the ability to feed ourselves. We can sustain ourselves without you. We're not playing those games anymore. And as a matter of fact, there are ways forward for America to where we wouldn't even need oil anymore. But these are things that we actually have to first wake up and take the Constitution back and actually start really looking, because we've actually exposed ourselves to an evolved government that, you know, do we need highways and waterways and these improvements so that we can be productive and become this, you know, the most economic powerhouse the world has ever known? Absolutely, we need to do that. But we don't need to do that at the federal level. So these are where we can actually start putting things on the table where we can finally be honest and talk about elephants in the room. You know, we got herds of elephants in the room and we need to actually start getting them out of the room so that we can take over again and actually have this government that allows us to be so productive and so enlightened that, you know, we could actually end world wars. And we haven't even gotten into Article 4, but, you know, I've said this before, that the Constitution is God's plan of globalism. And I think I may have mentioned to you that, you know, how great would it be if President Trump, when he became president, because I said this before he even became president, he should actually be petitioning Hong Kong. He should be petitioning, you know, these nations that are under threat, like Taiwan under China, or the Crimea with Russia. He should be going to these states and saying, why don't you, the people, vote to determine whether you want to be subject to Russia or China, or whether you want to transition into a state in the United States? Because Article 4, Section 3 allows us to do that. You can become a state here. If you vote to do that, then you become a territory and we can protect you. But we will never protect a state ever again, because you want to maintain your autonomy. If you want to maintain autonomy, then you're on your own. Autonomy is autonomy. You're going to be on your own, and you have to deal with the consequences if a despot like Saddam Hussein rises up and seizes control and starts killing you off. You can either live in a nation under the rule of law where liberty is protected and your life and property is valued and protected, or you can just continue to live in the state that you're living. These are things to ponder on, and as obviously we just ran out of time. So when we come back, we will dive back into this militia, because we just started going into it, because we need to kind of dive into subsection 15. So we'll pick it back up with subsection 13 and 14, or actually 14. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.